Hey, everybody, I'm Jody Vance.
And I'm George Affleck.
And we have so much to shoehorn into the next 30 minutes of Unspun Podcast. We have to start globally, truly, worldwide. Mm-hmm. Then we're going to take it nationally because there's so much discussion after our new Prime Minister, Mark Carney, has installed his cabinet. And we'll bring it all the way local because there's lots happening at the ledge. It is time for
Unspun.
George, I don't know how we do this in 30 minutes. I don't know how we do this.
Well, last week it took us 45.
So I know. Well,
our longest podcast ever, I think.
Well, I know. Well, we promised to bring it in on time. We take the spin out of the news cycle and we shoehorned it into 30 minutes. So wherever you're going, your podcast listening, driving, walking, doing, working out, treadmilling, you can catch up. So let's start globally. With world leaders, and in particular, the President of the United States, visiting the Middle East
and having Middle East
conversations
tour.
With
people who are classified as enemies of America, terrorists, people who were assigned people to chop up journalists into pieces, and it's like. It's a whole
Do you remember
new world
that long ago, Joe Biden, as when he was president, that he went there and he like wouldn't shake MBS's hand? And yesterday we were watching the bromance that was unfolding. Like some of the things that the US president was saying to MBS was.
I mean, our show's Unspun. And what do we think about this? I think it's interesting because I've seen some pundits who don't like Trump are saying if he could pull this off, which is, you know, whether or not Trump even knows what he's pulling off sometimes, of creating peace in the Middle East by embracing the non-Israel, you know, communities, cities, countries, and non-countries, and potentially announcing and saying he's going to support independent Palestine, which is apparently coming down the pike this week. That's where the rumor is. You know, this has made Israel very nervous. Israel is now saying we have to plan for, we know how this feels, for a country without America support. We know the feeling. So, you know, it's interesting to see these pundits, these people who are not generally supporting what he's doing in America, but are curious to watch this approach, which, yeah, it's horrible. These people have been done horrible things. But I guess Trump is trying to make a point. Like the other way wasn't working, so I'm going this way. And so it works
this way, like let's truly take the spin out of that as well. Because what's not in that conversation of hey, we might as well try this tactic? It billions upon billions upon billions of dollars in assets to the U.S. president in the form of a new golf club there worth $5 billion, a hotel with his name on it. You know, he loves it anytime there can be a Trump hotel somewhere, not to mention $400 million luxury flying palace, which, by the way, would then need to be taken apart down to inch by inch. Because I mean, are you accepting a vehicle for your president to move around the world in from somebody who has been, you know, traditionally not your ally? It's just so upside down. Like in this moment, I thought we were ending the Ukraine-Russia war on day one. You know, I thought that there was a clear picture of what things needed to look like in Israel and Gaza. And it's just horrifying what is unfolding there. It, you know, pick your sides, people, but wow, what we're seeing happen to innocents, because there are innocent people caught up in all of this. Like right back to, you know, Donald Trump is busy doing what he's doing in the Middle East. Meanwhile, there are young children across the planet who no longer have access to medical care that they once did because USA. The U.S. was there to support it. Like there's so much here. And I want to just kind of pull it all together like this. I was watching one U.S. pundit yesterday who said, you know, instead of focusing on the plane and the golf course and the property and what have you, there should be really across the board in U.S. politics the inability to profit from your office. And we're seeing that the Supreme Court justices who profit from their office, we're seeing, you know, politicians on both sides of the aisle, whether Democratic or Republican, profiting from being in office. I mean, this is not new. This is not new. The fact that it has gone to this grotesque level of not even feigning, hiding it in, you know, in any way, shape, or form. It's just wild what we're witnessing in real time. And I don't know if you can dial it back.
That's the problem. That slippery slope is so slippery now. I mean, of course, corruption and grift has been around forever in politics, and I think that Trump is certainly taking it to the next level, and to the most, at least he's transparent about it, I guess, as opposed to hiding it.
That's where we get to? At least the chaos maker's telling us what he's doing?
I know. It's, you know, there is a process that they can follow to stop it, but whether they do or not, I mean, it comes down to, so there's this is the issue, I think, that these pundits are talking about, which is what he's doing in as far as the international relations versus his domestic relations and the stuff he's doing with ICE and us crossing the border or coming back from the border where you have to go through a pre-border now. These are the and people are disappearing. They are moving towards absolute authoritarianism down there. It's clear.
Intimidating people, judges, people arresting judges,
and the citizens overall are accepting it. And I think that's the question: is when are you willing? You know, this is the question that I think you have to ask yourself in America, and the question we talked about this a few weeks ago. At what point do you rise up? Because the politicians need to know that you've got their back. While you might say leadership, Democrats need to do this, but if they don't have anything to anchor themselves to, then it's really hard for them to put themselves out there if they're not hearing the protests. So America, if they have a problem with, if the silent majority doesn't get more loud, this will just continue. And Canada and any Western nation is vulnerable to this. It's not this great concept of democracy and free market, and you know, it's not a given. You have to fight for it.
Post World War II. World order was established. There were parameters put in place, and those parameters are being knocked down. And beyond those parameters being knocked down, and we're Canadian, we're sitting here in Canada, watching the U.S. Constitution get shredded, like it's being shredded. But what it's also, I think, from in the unspun perspective, is what used to be absolute. This is the law of the land. This is how we do it. Like habeas corpus, like the right to a fair trial.
Goodbye.
Right? If that is the foundation.
And soon, if there are riots, as I think the next will be military action on the citizens. You know, I think that's where they will remove any power of judges. You know, we've talked about this. It's that, you know, we're sitting on the sidelines watching this as up here in Canada. It's going, and you know, you've got Alberta going, yay, we love it. Let's join that
before
country.
We go to Alberta.
Just like them.
Before we go to Alberta, what I think is so interesting here is how toothless all of that turns out to be in this moment. What has always stood is like, if you are called to sit before Congress and testify upon whatever inquiry, if you are called to do that and you don't answer the question, you're in jail. Like there are consequences to that. All of a sudden, all those consequences are gone. It's just all of a sudden you can ignore a subpoena. You cannot pay the fine. You cannot show up for your court date. All of these things have just, you know, happened all at once. I think it feels like America is kind of just in this state of shock, or the people that are like, this is our guy, he's who we voted for, don't really understand the consequences of this type of slippery slope again, that, you know, they're coming for them until all of a sudden they're coming for you. Like that is the biggest lesson from post-war Germany. I mean, I have really close personal friends who live currently in Germany, and the rules and laws around this type of behavior are very incredibly strict because it's happened there, right? Like it's happened that the order of their country was completely shattered by what at first people thought was just, you know, a man who was a bit off his rocker. and look at what happened there.
Well, there are three university professors from the States, you may have seen that, who are the experts in authoritarianism at three universities. And one is coming to Toronto, going to Toronto, the other two, I don't remember where they're going, but they have said it's not safe for us to be in America based on our historical knowledge as history professors of totalitarian countries. It's not, we are the first to go. As far as the first to go, if you stay, or the first to get out of the country before it's too late. And so that's saying something. And then, of course, there's this whole movement that we're having where every country is enticing all these amazing
scientists and healthcare scientists workers
to leave America. And while that's really great for all these countries, including Canada, like nurses, it's really devastating for America because they are the leader and they do have, it isn't, you know, to pull all these scientists away from all these projects is only going to have a long-term nightmare for us all, whether it's disease research or whatever it might be. Technology, it doesn't, you're taking away the brains of those people in the community that they've created in America.
All the research.
As great as it might be for the University of Toronto, it's still a bad news for the world because these things are not easy to build. So
that's why everybody's so freaked out right now. That's in a nutshell. Like the tearing apart of the fabric that has created some of the things that have expanded our life expectancy, you know, the things that save our children from being so ill. Let's bring it back to Canada. And you mentioned Alberta. We can talk about, you know, the whole separatist movement and the uprising today of First Nation and Indigenous peoples in Alberta going, wait, excuse me, what? Like, I don't believe that
my
you
belief,
can do this.
Yeah, well, populism
arbitrarily. But I was going to mention measles because I think that is the measles outbreaks in the United States are horrifying. Children are dying, unnecessary illness, long-term effects. It's going to be awful. But it's also happening here in Canada because of the anti-vaccine rhetoric that we've all witnessed. Mm-hmm. The measles vaccine is safe and effective. We should vaccinate our children against these diseases that are preventable because of science. And what's happening in Alberta right now is horrifying because of the innocent children that are sick, very, very sick now because of their parents' political stubbornness to do their own research around science. And you were just mentioning the importance of science. I just wanted to go on the record saying, vaccinate your children. Vaccination.
Yeah, well, you know, the referendum in Alberta, it comes from that anger that's happening in Alberta, I think stems from COVID and the anger that, you know, that touches on that subject as well, sort of that started there. But this decision by Daniel Smith, the premier of Alberta, to jump on this bandwagon and referendum and separatism. And it's the, you know, if you're a politician and you go for the lowest common denominator, you're not, it's not a winning formula for leadership. It's just
for
not,
most people.
It's easy, but it's not long lasting. It's comes across as fake to the majority and it's just not, it doesn't generally work. And it's just not leadership. So, you know, we'll see how this turns out for her, but I would say that she wasn't given a mandate by the people of Alberta to hold a referendum. And I've always, you know, I'm not a big fan of referendums. I feel like it's a cop-out. You make a decision as a politician. It's like abstaining in a vote at city council, which we've talked about in the past.
Right,
like, you know, I voted for you to make some decisions for me. If you can't make those decisions, then get the hell out. So
that's right.
Daniel Smith doing a referendum about separatism, like people, majority, I'm sure in Alberta went, what? Like, just because there's a loud bunch of people who are separatists, they've always been there. I mean, I remember as a kid that this was a conversation.
Sure.
My dad was like, and pay me $1 million and I'd move to America or whatever. Like, I'm like, you know, back in the 70s, I'm like, what? This was a movement back then. And it's just, and it's tied to the oil
prices.
There's
always going to be that fringe, though. There's always going to be.
Yes. And so it's a question, a brave politician doesn't jump on bandwagon like that.
Right. It just, yeah, never ceases to amaze how headline grabbing that fringe can be, right? That's real. Let's talk some headlines on a national scale. I know we like zipped from U.S. politics or global politics right into Alberta, kind of related.
That's a national.
It is, but let's go like national in that Prime Minister Carney introduced his cabinet, and I found it really interesting because a lot of conservatives in the lead up to the election were screaming about how the Liberals and their big government and very pared down is the cabinet that was put forward by Prime Minister Carney. A couple of big surprises, perhaps, in who was named and to which files said politicians were named.
I was pretty vocal. I was one of the only ones when I was called by a few media outlets talked about Gregor Robertson as the housing minister. And apparently I was the only one willing to say negative things about it publicly.
Really?
Well, I think a lot of people don't want it because they feel like, oh, it's anti-Canada to go negative so soon on Carney. And I'm like, this isn't about Carney. Well, it is a bit. My comments on News 1130 or whatever it's called, City News, whatever it's called now. You know, tone deaf of the Prime Minister who doesn't understand how people really don't like Gregor Robertson here. Certainly in Vancouver, they don't like him. And on the housing file, he's an absolute disaster in the minds of everybody in this province. I don't know anybody who would think that Gregor Robertson did a good job on housing at all, except for his absolute devoted followers who are now working for him in Ottawa. You know, they're all the same crew. I see these pictures in Ottawa. I'm like, oh my God, Vision Vancouver now is running our country. Oh God, all these same people are in Ottawa now behind Carney. And I'm like, God help us. You know, and it's not a criticism of Carney and the Liberals. They won the election, but it's a real bad sign. And then, of course, immediately, and I think Gregor Robertson doesn't realize he's not a mayor. He's not the leader anymore. He's just a guy of a department. He must be getting his hand slapped for what he said yesterday about supply and pricing. The only answer to a question about housing at this point in time for Gregor Robertson is, hey, it's too soon. I just got the gig. We're going to be meeting. We're going to be figuring this out. Obviously, there's issues in this country. You know, I faced it and was challenged by it in Vancouver. Absolutely. And I learned a lot. And I'm going to do what I can to learn more and help Canada find a solution. But that solution I can't provide you right now. But he immediately went into, just like he said, he was going to solve homelessness. He makes these pronouncements that are just like so bad for Carney. Carney's just probably going, shut up.
Yeah.
Shut up. And then the guy from Quebec about the pipelines, like, shut up. And then there's no budget coming. Shut up. Like, why are you guys talking?
Watching the interview about housing, I found very triggering, and I kept in my mind going back to, well, the rest of the city and beyond were struggling to the nth degree. He was building little parkettes at the end of his street in preparation to sell his duplex, right? He's got like a bike lane light at the end of his street so he could, you know, he beautified his little neighborhood so he could sell to the highest bidder when he moved out of the house in Point Grey. I will never forget that as a Vancouverite, that in the moment where we were all looking at one another going, where are our young people going to live? Where are our healthcare workers supposed to go? You know, nobody can live here. Nobody can afford to live here. And the housing market, and I would put Christy Clark in the same category as Gregor Robertson in the complacency piece, because they were here doing this at the same time. They knew exactly what was happening. They saw those transfers, those property taxes and land transfer fees and everything that were happening like a shell game. You know, it was not, in hindsight, we all know what was happening and what continues to happen in the quote unquote Vancouver model. Very little has been done really meaningfully. And that he pointed to the empty homes tax as a win, as something that was really working. I mean, I found it all quite triggering, and I could agree with you in that I believe that should the Prime Minister have been watching live, highly unlikely, or watched it back, he would have been doing exactly what you said he was doing, probably pulling his hair out, saying, just please stop talking. Please stop talking.
Well, two things. One, regarding, you know, when Vancouver, you know, their approach, and this is when I was in council, obviously, and my fight was, you know, times are prosperous. You don't need to encourage the free market to build through, you know, massive tax incentives and waiving of fees to build unaffordable rental housing. This is not a good approach in times when they're good. When times are good, save the cash. Or if you're going to do anything, then build stuff that nobody else wants to build. And if you're going to spend the tax money, then build stuff that nobody else wants to build. But they didn't do that. They gave all the tax incentives saying they were going to do this, that, and they promised they were going to build, you know, social housing. The other thing, though, for Carney, and I've talked about this before, is that, you know, if you don't control your caucus, you're out of business. You know, to think that he's in week one and he's already lost control of his caucus, clearly. And, you know, he may be able to rein it in, but it's not a good start. You don't usually get upstarts out of the gate like this. It's really,
in the
really
first
bad. And
week.
he's got to show some strength. He's got to get rid of one of those guys. One of them has
Right.
to go. One of them has to go. Otherwise,
That's
he will
a
be
good point.
seen by the caucus itself as weak. And then the knives will start coming out for Carney, and you'll have another election in 8, 9 months.
So we just need to be more clear because we kind of glazed over the Guilbeault, the discussion, the interview about, would you greenlight pipelines? And he basically said no, which everybody glommed onto. It became the headline. I watched Vassi Capello's interview, finance minister as well, Champagne, about like they're all getting uppity in their reactions. Like they need crisis management. They need to just like. They need to carny it. They need to slow their roll, calm it down, say what they're doing. This is what we're doing. You can keep asking that question. Like, you're not going to green light pipelines. We knew it. It's like the end of the sentence was even lost. And this is when we're talking about this member of parliament and how he answered the question. It seems novice. It seems like a no-brainer that you say no decision on pipelines will be made until interprovincial trade is sorted. Everybody needs to be on board because that was the whole answer. But he said, no, I wouldn't greenlight pipelines, and then continued his answer, which nobody heard because everybody just took that snippet and ran with it because that's your headline, right? Like, you know that, and I know that. What are you doing? If you listen to how Mark Carney speaks, he speaks in, I'm not giving you definitives now, even when he was challenged about budgets. He's like, how do I give you a budget in uncertain times where we're just laying the groundwork with our biggest trading partner in the United States? Well, I'll have a better idea. I can give you a budget, but I can't stand by it because I don't know what the landscape looks like. That was the answer that I'm paraphrasing, but largely that Carney gave. And the finance minister, Champagne, said, well, we're going to give it this day because we're totally transparent and we're da 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 da. He kept saying, we're totally transparent, we're totally, which led the David Cochrans of the world or the Vassi Capellos to say, that's not transparent. No budget is not transparent. What are you talking about? Which is a fair rebuttal. Because what he should say is, there's no way to do a budget right now, given the chaos that is before us and the fact that we've just taken office. We're going to need to have a look at this for a minute.
Well, the leadership within the party didn't make a didn't the minister didn't get the memo, or the memo wasn't sent out, which was shut the fuck up, don't say anything, don't talk, don't give your opinions, because we don't have the answer
We don't have the
yet.
answer.
And
Right.
so it's ridiculous. You literally got sworn in like 3 days ago. Stop.
Yeah,
And that
stop
memo,
talking.
either if it went out, they didn't listen to it. And that means you've got rogue politicians in your caucus, which is a real problem. So I'll be interested to see how this goes. And I would say that Gregor was already on an uphill battle in this market, which will taint the other liberals in a negative way. I mean, how's Wade Grant gonna, fare if Gregor keeps screwing up? How are the other
Right.
good MPs in this province who are liberals gonna fare when you've got a crappy MP, in my mind, in
And we deserve
Vancouver?
representation in Ottawa. We deserve
Sure.
this
But
side
why
of
do
the
they choose the
Rockies.
guy that's not the best choice? Like, if all the
Right.
and that, you look at the weight of, you've got 11 ministers in Ontario, and you've got 14 across the rest of Canada,
Doesn't
from
surprise me.
e for west. You tell me you couldn't find a you couldn't find more people to run, and you've got, I think, eight or nine or whatever it is in the Maritimes. It's ridiculous. It's so no wonder Alberta's angry. There is a lack of balance in our in our in house. So it's we'll see. But I'm very disappointed in how these politicians, these people have gone rogue, and so
It's
soon they
interesting
really
that you
shouldn't
think one of
have.
them's got to go. That's it. Well,
He has to show
you're very
strength.
good at, pardon?
Yeah, he has to show strength.
You're very good at predicting these things, George Affleck. I'm telling you, you have a way. You have a witchy way to you, my friend. Let's talk about BC politics. The legislature has been very busy, to say the least. Where to begin, honestly?
Well, Dallas Brody was too busy tweeting out racist comments about First Nations to show up at the ledge to vote. What the hell is that about? I mean, come on. I mean, she's got her support. Talk about somebody who's speaking to a base that is small. Like, what are you doing? I
Tiny.
mean, the whole. Well, anyways, she is on. She's whatever. She's an independent now, so whatever. But they had a chance to
I find
call
it disgusting.
to to call the, you know, anyways, it's, I just think that it's already a mess there. It's this 46-46 thing is brutal.
It is a mess. Mm-hmm. Lots of discussion around the Lapu-Lapu tragedy, and Premier David Eby basically standing up in the legislature, saying, calling him a murderer, calling the untried perpetrator of this horrible, tragic event. And then he had to walk that back. Of course, it's his day in court and, you know, but impassioned. What do you think of that?
Well, I think this guy has clearly mental health care issues, which is a whole other issue. Right. I think that Ken Sim came out too fast in Vancouver to a press conference with all the politicians standing behind him. Blah, like so bad, like stop. But you know, the issue of why there were trucks parked there. I don't know if there was any way to stop this horrible thing that happened. This guy had a breakdown, whatever it was, you know, he clearly should have been in some kind of institution. And guess what? We don't have any institutions left. Thanks, NDP. You got rid of them in 1993. So whatever. And you got rid of housing too, by the way, 1993. Thanks, NDP. You know, and federal liberals for that matter. So, you know, we have this situation where we have somebody who didn't get the care he needed, in my mind.
I am going to jump in on the horrible NDP what he and did federal liberals, because there was a big chunk in there that had conservatives and they didn't build anything either. So
1993.
I'm telling you, though, Gretchen, but I lived through the Harper years and I didn't see any of those institutions nor housing being built. So I blame all of our politicians who have stood back and done the like, well, that's not a popular thing. Let's throw that football down the field a little bit. I think the time for tossing the political football is over.
You're right. And you know what? 1993, Kretchen got rid of the housing program.
Yes, he didn't replace it with anything.
He didn't replace it with anything. NDP got rid of the health, mental health care programs and institutions.
Yeah.
Didn't replace it with anything. They were both followed by right of center parties who didn't do anything that should have been done. Either they should have gone backwards and done what we used to have. They didn't do that.
Right.
So, yeah, you're right.
Or create new infrastructure. Where the hell is the new infrastructure?
It wasn't the conservatives who shut the programs down, though.
No. I'm not suggesting that it was. I'm just saying for the interest of Unspun, the balance here is these files have been mishandled by every elected official municipally, provincially, and federally since 1993. And I think they have radically changed how our country, and in particular in on the south coast of British Columbia, because we are the Hawaii of Canada, where when people have nowhere to go, they can live on the streets here and not die in the middle of winter for the most part, and not die in the middle of summer for the most part. And that's why I lived for a short period of time in Los Angeles. I lived in Venice Beach, which is just down the road from Santa Monica, and there was a cardboard city that would be set up every night in Santa Monica Pier on the park, and every homeless person would go from all over LA, and they'd go and they'd gather together and live on the beach for the night. And then they get up in the morning and they take down their cardboard and they'd go, you know, panhandle and do whatever, try and survive, try and live with nothing. You know, we're seeing the live with nothing here. It's a global phenomenon, but it's just, there's a lot of discussion around it and very little meaningful action around, like you said, building the space for people who clearly cannot move through society. I predict, I hate this prediction, but it's true. I predict that we will go through all of the legal proceedings with this individual and we will come to the conclusion in our justice system that he is unfit to stand trial due to mental health issues.
Like, which is a tragedy on so many ways. Tragedy. So many tragedies here. This is not, that's why it's kind of, nobody's really, it's not being talked about the way if it was a terrorist attack, because it was not. It was a guy who was nuts and had went on a rampage.
We don't even know why.
I don't think
why.
He said sorry when he got out of the car.
He has a valid driver's license. That's the one thing that they're starting to say now. Maybe people deemed, you know, medically unstable and sort of a little bit on house arrest, like they have to be in the supervision of their parent or of a guardian. Maybe those people don't get driver's licenses. Sorry, what? We're just getting to that point now. It's just a little crazy.
I mean, that's, and there is a story. I mean, that's the issue, right? It's whose roles and responsibilities we're talking about, not on just this file, but on all the files. And, yeah. And generally, I think a lot of this responsibility has to go to Ottawa. And we've talked about this, because if you share the pain and the cost to every Canadian, it's not as much money. If Vancouver wants to solve homelessness, it's impossible. If Vancouver wants to build housing, it can't do it for all the people, as you mentioned, who are coming here because it's the most likable place to come. And it also has a lot of the services that are literally on the same road. If we were to spread the pain, spread the cost, and also maybe think about Vancouver, okay, clearly it has one of the biggest problems and the most unaffordable housing, not only in Canada, it's not the world. When you see Gregor Robertson's comment, it was so related to market housing and not related to, you know, the true, so that's always been my comment to him and his party when they were there, is what we need to be focusing on true affordable housing, social housing. That's social the only housing, thing rental government stocks, should be focused
things
on.
Things that people can afford on their one job, and they can still have a life, and they can still, go out to the local coffee shop on a regular for a burger, that it's not 75% of their income to rent a space that doesn't house their, you know, family of three, you know,
Finland,
studio apartment for three people for $2,500 a month is
Finland and Denmark, two of the happiest places on earth. Guess what they have? Robust housing programs and a very strong mental health care and healthcare system. Very expensive to live there.
Very expensive. They take 80% of your taxes, but you pay for nothing.
But you get something in return. And if you talk to anybody in those countries, and I lived in Denmark, they say, well, you got to give back. You can choose to be successful and make a lot of money because we respect the market economy, but we also understand that some people do not fare as well in life, and they need to be taken care of. There's a basic
George
understanding
a
of that.
Socialist. No. George is a socialist. No, I'm kidding. I mean, that's what people will say, though. I mean, you're Canadian. Not wrong. People are like, Denmark, they're going to take all my money. How am I supposed to pay for childcare? It's like, but in Denmark, you don't pay for childcare. Childcare is provided for you so that you can live in the affordable home with the supports you need, access to the school. You also don't pay for university. All of the things that are the expenses that we leave up to the markets that do this, and all of a sudden only certain people can afford those luxuries like childcare, healthcare, education.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at what point do we say, you know what, maybe you do take a little bit more of my paycheck and we fix this stuff?
Well, otherwise, you know this, we got kids. Otherwise, guess what happens now? You know, I was the chair of my kids' PAC. The amount of fundraising we had to do. I'm like, why?
Oh, it's crazy.
When did this start happening? When I was a kid, pencils were provided. Like, there's stuff in the cupboard that came through a budget
Teachers
that wasn't raised by parents.
Out of their own pockets to photocopy the work that kids are doing in class. It's wild, George.
There's only one taxpayer, so you might as well just admit that.
Both of our kids are graduating this year. We're going to be flush, baby.
I got one more year. I got one more year.
Shoot. I'm going to post-secondary.
But you got to get him a job.
I know. Oh, mine's got a job.
I don't
get a job. He just got it. Thank God. Last point, just before. Actually, we're at 30 minutes, aren't we?
You can make your last point.
I was going to make one last point about the influx of healthcare workers. We touched on it a little bit at the top. I think that's one positive thing that is coming from the legislature, hearing Health Minister Josie Osborne and David Eby speak directly to the idea of putting out, similarly to Albertans who are like, come live here, it's cheaper. I like the fact that in BC we're saying, come here, we're going to fast track your ability to come and work in the BC healthcare system. And 1,000 nurses from the US have already stepped up and applied to move here. 1,000 nurses is a very crazy good number. Again, where do they live? How does this work? Whatever. But being able to activate their credentials in a swift way, I think, is an excellent first step. There are many nurses. There was one story of a nurse in Florida. She and her wife no longer feel safe in Florida as a queer couple, and both of them being nurses, and she wants to move here. That is a Canadian story in my mind. That is a Canadian story. I love that we are a safe place for people who feel that for whatever reason they need to leave the US. I would also like to say that there are many, 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 many millions of people in the US who love Canadians and are standing up for us, and I hope more of them do.
On that note, later, Gator.
Follow along on social media. You can find George at George.
Underscore.
Affleck, George underscore Affleck. I'm at Jody Vance, Jody with a Y, at Jody Vance. We talk every week on Unspun Podcast. Hope you enjoyed it. Your fastest 30 minutes in, well, not just BC politics, federal politics and global politics. We thought we'd have a slow news week at some point. We're almost 300 episodes in, so.
Bye-bye.